and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you, and the phone lines are open if you'd like to join us. 941-3689 is the number if you call us from Oahu. And from the neighbor islands or anywhere else, you can reach us at 877-941-3689. And you can tweet me at BKOZHPR. Chances are you're getting your news from a variety of places, legacy media, including TV and radio, and especially online. But what if some gigantic media company were pre-selecting what sites you could see and at what speed they would download, if in fact you had internet access at all? My guest tonight says that's not hyperbole, it's reality. And as in that film from 38 years ago, you know the one, once you realize what's at stake, you'll get mad as hell and do something about it. This week, Michael Copps is in Hawaii speaking about the same issues he championed during the almost 11 years he spent as a member of the Federal Communications Commission. Since 2011, he's been on the road to talk with communities across the country. Now he's spearheading a new media democracy and reform initiative at Common Cause. Why? Well, he says, all you have to do is look at the declining state of America's news and information infrastructure, particularly the state of the news, the consolidation of the media and telecommunications industry, and the government's neglect of its responsibility to oversee the public interest. Michael Copps, welcome to Town Square.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. I'm delighted to be here and be on the road, and there's no better place to be than right here in Hawaii.
Well, we have a number of challenges here, and you talked a little bit about that during some of the other conversations that we've had over the past several days that you've been here. But, you know, for anyone who says, hey, there's nothing that gets between me and my internet, it's free, it's open, I can get anything I want, anytime I want, you say it ain't so.
Yeah, I say, you know, a lot of us thought maybe that that's the way it was going to be, that this broadband and internet technology was so dynamic that nothing could stand in the way, nothing could get between you and the end user and the website you want to get to. We just forgot a little bit that that's not how business runs in a capitalistic free enterprise system. Any business, whether it's old-fashioned media or now new media, is going to be looking to gain as much power in the market as they can, have as much influence as they can, to control what they can. You don't necessarily blame business for that, but you realize that when that gets out of control and starts tending toward monopoly or oligopoly, that then you have to have some public interest oversight in the government needs to step in, and we're at that point. What you can see now is the coming of more and more consolidation, fewer and fewer gatekeepers in control of the highways and byways of the internet, and it's harder for the small website, the small blog to be heard. The big companies are in control increasingly of both content and distribution. They have enormous power. They have the power, as I say, to gatekeep. Right now, since the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals, a federal court, a few weeks ago voided the even weak rules that the FCC had to maintain internet freedom and open internet, there is nothing. There is absolutely nothing to keep a Comcast or Verizon or Time Warner, a big internet company, from blocking content, whatever they want. If they don't like a certain advocacy group or whatever, there's nothing left to keep them from either blocking content or prioritizing their own businesses or their big deep-pocketed friends who pay them to speed up traffic. So what should be really a golden age of communications is heading down the wrong road, and it's not just a question about technologies. It's really a question about democracy, because if we're going to move a lot of our civic dialogue, our radio and television and our Town Square of democracy, if we're going to move that toward the internet, then we have to make sure that internet is really serving the public interest, that it's open, that it's accessible, so we can really have a town square of democracy paved with broadband bricks. We're not heading in that way right now. We're tearing the bricks out. That's what we're doing.
this isn't a specter of coming attractions. I mean, you're really clear. This is what's happening right now. There's nothing to prevent any of those companies that you named. I mean, that's a very, very scary thought to think that somebody would say, no, I don't think you should see this. And yes, maybe this is what I want you to see. And I'll massage your habits this way.
Right.
Do we find ourselves falling into naive a position and not realizing that this is, in fact, happening?
Well, I think so. You're right. I mean, when you're in the theater and the coming attractions end and you go to the feature presentation, we're in the feature presentation now. That's what we're that's what we're watching. And I think people are increasingly aware of it. And I'm particularly enthused, partly as a result of my visit here to Honolulu the last few days and being out to the university and talking with young people, students, lawyers in training, journalists in training. I think they're increasingly aware of this. And, you know, I've been singing the song about the dangers of consolidation for many years. And I think when I was talking about radio and television and cable, I think a lot of folks thought, well, that may be true, but, you know, that's passé. Who cares? These things are gone. They're not really gone. But now I think young people are beginning to wake up to the fact and to see very clearly, some of them, that this is a danger for them. This is what they're predicating their future on, is open Internet. That Internet's going to find them a job. You don't send in a resume to a Fortune 500 company anymore to find a job. They don't even look at those. You do that online. Increasingly, we're going to be educating ourselves online. We're already doing a lot of that, but it's going to become much, much more transformative than it is now. Online medicine, telehealth, and all of that. So this is so important to our future. It's such a opportunity-creating technology, and we need to be taking advantage of it. And instead, what we're doing is sort of allowing it to go down that road of cableization, like the cable industry. When how many people out here are going to get really enthused about the service they're getting from their cable company? All they're getting is slow service and increasingly high bills. But I suppose if you want to cableize the Internet, who better to do it than Comcast, the biggest cable company of all? So we're going to turn the Internet over to them, Internet access over to them. I think we're asking for trouble, but it would make a pretty good feature presentation, pretty good movie, wouldn't it?
Well, movies, I mean, there's been a lot of chatter lately about the fact that network, although it may be 38 years old, it seems to be increasingly modern in its approach to what's been happening with the Internet, forgetting just networks and TV, but just applying the same thing to what we're seeing happen with media, period.
Right.
And that's a pretty scary thought, but equally as scary for a lot of people may be the idea that, well, it's insurmountable, or that really you can't fight this in some way. And it doesn't matter if you get mad as hell, you're not going to be able to do anything about it. And you say that's not true.
I say that's not true. I say you can fight it. I say it's a big struggle. It's an uphill struggle. Years ago, before I came to Washington, D.C., I used to teach American history, and I used to read about the Gilded Age and the power of the special interests and the robber barons and the gatekeepers of old, and how John D. Rockefeller combined distribution with content and got control of so many aspects of our economy. But the more you look around at the reality of where we live right now in the United States in the 21st century, that Gilded Age back in the 1880s and 90s didn't have that much on where we are now. We have an outrageous influence of big money. We have special interests that are not just walking the corridors of power, but they're determining who else is walking, who's in those corridors of power. They're writing the legislation. They're influencing and writing the regulations. And we all know about special interests, I think, and we all know that we've had a lot of consolidation in a lot of different industries. But we have to realize that this is different. This isn't just railroads or food or something like that. This media industry is dependent upon a public resource, which is the airwaves that belong to the people of the United States of America. They're not a company or a person in the United States that owns a hertz of spectrum. We, the people, own the spectrum. It's a public resource, And what bothers me is it produces a public good, but we're not going to let it really do that job. And when I say produces a public good, I'm talking about news and information to nourish the civic dialogue, to bring facts to people, not glitzy infotainment, but real facts, not shouted opinion, but real hard-headed analysis, real journalism. And we'll talk more about that, I guess. But journalism has been so mightily damaged. And if you look at the state of the nation in the world right now, we're not doing so well. We've got a lot of problems economically, socially, lots of other ways, too. And if we're going to get around those problems and surmount those obstacles, it's going to have to be because the American people make good decisions for the future. And the only way the American people can make good decisions for the future is to be informed citizens. And I know it's a harsh term, but I think that as a result of some of these things we've talked about already and we'll talk more about, we have dumbed down the civic dialogue in this country to a point of real danger for the future of our democracy.
As we look at the future, and as you noted a moment ago, looking at history, that's also something that has gone, in many cases, by the wayside, and a lot of civics courses and understanding of where you fit in, how history fits in, and the same chestnut that we hear time and time again, that if we don't remember history, we are doomed to repeat it. And that seems to be borne out by what you say we're seeing right now with media.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, to really get at the problem, you have to. We have to have this front and center in our education for our kids. We need, you can call it new literacy or media literacy or digital literacy. I don't know what you call it, but we have to start at an early level, teaching kids not just how to use these tools, but how the tools can use and misuse them. We have to treat them at a or teach them at a young age, you can go, this is a site that you can trust. This is something you can't trust. What's the difference between fact and opinion and all? And, you could put together, we should do this, and we could do it very quickly, a K-12 online new literacy kind of curriculum that you could fit in to any school curriculum. It wouldn't be federally mandated. The government and the private sector could have a partnership to put this program up online, and if a school board wanted to use it, they could use it and start teaching the kids. But you're so right, and the civics and the history that I used to teach is playing a much less prominent role in our schools. We all understand the need for STEM education, and I agree with that too, but not at the expense of teaching people how to be good citizens and how to inform themselves and how to sustain the democracy that we are fortunate enough to live in, but which is increasingly jeopardized by the power of special interests.
So, I mean, even if we were to have the kind of curriculum that you just talked about, wouldn't that not matter at all if there were still a gatekeeper and you couldn't really trust what you were getting because it's still owned by big media?
Well, that's true, but by the same token, I think you have to, the more people are informed and they understand how it works, then you get some movement from that end as well as to try to improve the situation. But we need to take steps now. We need to take it urgent. Long term, it's not just going to be an online course K-12 that maybe you take once or twice a week in the lower grades or a little more frequently in the upper grades. That's going to be a whole revision of our educational curriculum, training a new generation of teachers. That takes time. That takes creativity. That takes money. That's not going to happen right away. I'm just talking about how can we stem the hemorrhage right now, staunch the hemorrhage, and provide something to get us on the road to understanding these tools and preparing the way so we can take full advantage of them so they actually help us create opportunities for our kids and, in my case, grandkids.
You're listening to former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps in Hawaii this week. We're talking about your internet and the fact that although you may believe it's free and open and you have access to all kinds of things, in fact, you may not. And how do you feel about someone being the gatekeeper and by simply showing you certain things, omitting others, and not giving you a freedom of choice? Michael Copps says that's happening, and nothing less than your democracy with a little d is at stake. We want to hear what you have to say about that. 941-3689-877, 941-3689 If you call us from the neighbor islands, that's the number to use. You know, people hear conversations like this and they think, oh, well, that's so academic. You know, this is, I have a life. I have to do all this stuff. I have a family. I have a mortgage. And the list goes on and on and on. And it gets easier and easier to find other reasons not to pay attention to this until, in some cases, it could be too late. Are we at the point yet where it's too late?
No, we're not at the point where it's too late. It's late in the game. It's late in the day, later than it should be. But it's never too late to try to change these things.
The fact that in 2002 the FCC could have recognized that the Internet was, in fact, telecommunications and not just a service, and the fact that there was such a big boo-boo that now they're going to have an opportunity to go back and hopefully retool with the FCC rules, it seems that that's putting us at a very unique position in the history of the Internet and how we want to regulate it.
Well, I was there when that happened. And, you know, if you read the Telecommunications Act, it talks about advanced telecommunications. And it's clear to me that that encompassed broadband. Broadband was not unknown in 1996 when Congress wrote the bills. But I was at the FCC when this happened. I didn't approve of it. But in 2005, and this was a Republican majority commission at the time led by Michael Powell, who was our chairman, Colin Powell's son, the majority voted to say that cable broadband wasn't really telecommunications. This was something different. Let's call it an information service. Now, why is that important? And I don't want to get too caught into the weeds here, caught up in all kinds of unnecessary details. But the plain fact is that if you call something a telecommunications, what it is, telecommunications, that means it's under a part of the law where we have consumer protections, where we have requirements for universal service, meaning building out telephone service, telecommunications, and broadband to every
access
American,
to everyone.
Reasonably comparable services at reasonably comparable prices all across the nation. We have some protections for privacy, for public safety and emergency calling and all that sort of thing. If you're going to say this new technology, well, that's not telecommunications, it's information service, you put it over in a part of the law where these consumer protections do not exist. You know, generations of reformers fought to make sure that plain old telephone service had some semblance of consumer protection. And it just boggles my mind to think that people could say, well, nobody really wants those consumer protections with regard to broadband. This is how we're going to communicate. This is the new center of the telecommunications and media ecosystem, and we have to have those protections there. But that happened in 2002. Then 2005 was, well, it's not just the cable modem, but it's the telephone, telephone too. So I think we are the only country in the world that ever went through kind of a semantical exercise like that and put the development of broadband on hold, and really while other countries were building out and soaring ahead of us in the rankings, we kind of stood still. I don't know where we are right now. The OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a respected international organization, says the United States is 16th. It was like number one or two when I went to the FCC in 2001. There are other rankings that have us in the 20s. I read the other day about a couple of studies are out now, and one of them says 55 or 58, I think it was, in terms of speed. I don't know whose ranking is right, and you can quibble about them, but I do know
that we're
the United States of America is not anywhere near where it should be, which is in the vanguard, and we're kind of an also-ran. The capital of the United States, Washington, D.C., has worked itself up to about the same speeds as citizens in Riga, Latvia have. Only they pay about $20-some, $21 or $22 a month for that. In Washington, you pay like $115 or $120 or something like that. So we're getting...
And consider yourself lucky if you get it.
Yeah, and you're really lucky if you can get it. So we are getting slow broadband, much slower than we need, and we're paying much more for it than we should. So that should affect everybody. listening to this program. They're paying the bills.
Well, we've got callers who are coming in who are figuring out that this does, in fact, affect them, and they've got some questions for you. Our number is 941-3689. Call sooner rather than later. 941-3689 if you're on Oahu. Use that number from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, 877-941-3689. Going to Scott calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Scott. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. I know you guys are talking about net neutrality, and this is sort of slightly off topic, but I was interested to find out what he thought of in terms of consumer protectionism and things like that, that when they relaxed the ownership rules for radio stations and media during the Bush administration, which had a profound effect on the market in Hawaii, in that previously they were restricted to not being able to own more than one station or more than one media outlet in a particular market, but now because large corporations can come in and buy all the radio stations, et cetera, we have an extremely homogenous radio landscape, and that affects the amount, the type of entertainment that gets brought in, as well as, again, you listen to the same thing on multiple stations because there's the number of pipes that have been sort of reduced.
Well, Scott, you are absolutely on target. This has been kind of my cause since I went to the FCC in 2001. One of the first things that happened when I got there was that the chairman of the commission, Chairman Powell, decided that we needed to relax these ownership rules, as you just so rightly pointed out, and they proceeded to do that, and that ushered in this whole era of consolidation where you had a startup company like Clear Channel in the 1970s. By 2010 or whenever, I don't know, it investments in 1,200 stations. You have the networks with all of their increasing power. But to be perfectly fair, that has not slowed down under the new Democratic majority-led Federal Communications Commission, because it wasn't, and I'm a Democrat, I was part of that majority. But it wasn't too long after the new administration came to town in 2009 that Comcast came waltzing into the office with this idea that they wanted to take over NBC Universal. And you talk about merger, the mother of all mergers, I guess I would call that one, at least up until that period of time. And I was the only dissenting vote at the Federal Communications Commission on this merger. It passed 4-1, and we can talk more about that because it's a fascinating story, but it has had, all of this consolidation has had exactly the kind of pernicious effects that you talk about, the homogenization of programming. You know, you could get on a boat here in Honolulu and go to Los Angeles and get in a car and drive across to the East Coast, and you'd hear mostly the same kind of music. You would hear mostly the same kind of bland, fact-free news. You wouldn't be able to enjoy the different cultural music that you would get if you were driving in the old days through the country, and you'd hear Motown or Cajun or Appalachian or something like that.
You could tell where you were.
You could tell. Yeah, you didn't need GPS. You could tell. You could tell where you were. And the other huge victim of this was just the downsizing of the newsrooms, because that's what, joint company. Well, let's shut one of the newsrooms. I think that happened right here in Honolulu, and it happened in many, many other places. Or sharing newsrooms, but it all led to a cutback in journalism. So we now have 20 or 30 or 40,000, it's hard to find the exact figure, of newsroom people who used to be newsroom employees and journalists who used to be walking the beat looking for stories to hold power accountable. Now they're walking the streets looking for a job. And I must say, after having been out here the last 3 days, I don't want to say, I've been here 3 days, so I know all about Honolulu, but from what I've heard and what I've seen, I think the situation out here is worse even than I thought it was going to be coming in, from the standpoint of the uniformity of voices in basically one newspaper, consolidated newspaper town, and the only triopoly, really, in the country, where you have three stations basically spewing out the same news and information. That's not good. That's not good for news and information. That's not good for reflecting the diversity of culture that exists here. And my goodness, what diversity you have here in Honolulu and across the islands. Are those voices being heard? And I've been to so many town meetings across the United States where minority groups will come up and say, "What? Our culture is not covered. If it is covered, it's caricatured, you know, if it's what you'd hear was, well, if, you know, if it's going to be a story about Latinos or something, it's going to be immigration or crossing the border, it's going to be about illegal immigration. If it's African Americans, the story is going to be about crime or something like that. And that's the crime right there, to so caricaturize and so stereotype our culture when you bother to report on them. And part of that fact, of course, is that minorities and women own such few stations in the United States of America, and it's becoming harder and harder to own them because you have all of this consolidation. But I think it's important who owns a station. I think it's reflected in the programming that station runs. We do not have right now, as far as I know, in the United States of America, one black-owned, full-power commercial television station. And in a country that's over 30% now, over a third, I think, minority, and probably by the middle of the century is going to be the minorities will be the majority. The figures are shocking. Minorities owning maybe 3% of full-power stations, women 5 or 6%. That's not reflective of our culture. And that costs us if we don't reflect the culture. And if we don't hear that diversity of voices and hear them sing the diversity of songs and the diversity of poetry, but most of all, the diversity of input into the decisions we have to make, we're asking for trouble, big trouble.
And when you layer on top of that the cross-pollination of media ownership, not media just within your own type of media, but being able to own print.
Well, that's the thing right now. You know, they used to say, well, we're going to have all this intermodal competition and all that. These companies are all becoming more like one another. Comcast was a cable company. Then all of a sudden it was into other sorts of content, into broadcasting with NBC. Now it's the Internet. Same goes for a lot of these other companies. They're all becoming just huge conglomerates that do all the different aspects of media.
We've got lots of callers on the line. If you want to join us, do it soon. 941-3689. If you call from Oahu, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And we're going to go now to Chris calling us from the North Shore. Aloha, Chris. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the point that under our current system, that's sort of, you know, we're already having media kind of buried by search result companies. You now can get these third-party companies to come in and make false search results. It's a story under the current system. You know, anybody can try Googling the flavor saver tomato and look at the results you get under that. You know, you won't find the truth about it. You find a bunch of prepared statements by employees of the company that doesn't want you to know the truth. And that, you know, if we lose the internet neutrality, we're pretty much just handing over the wheel.
Well, you seem to be making the same point that Michael Copps is making, using a different example, perhaps. But, you know, the idea that this is not well known, even the term net neutrality. Now, I know that's one that Michael Copps hates a lot, because who's going to get all hoo-hoo over net neutrality? But the idea of internet freedom puts it into a completely different context. When you talk about this with your friends, Chris, do they get this? Is this really a topic of conversation?
What I find is most people don't know what I'm talking about until I explain it to them, the issue of internet neutrality. And, you know, another way to put this into context is, you know, it's really simple and easy to say, okay, well, they might stop all your internet traffic to Netflix. So you would have to go to Amazon to buy your online streaming content. But what if one of these internet companies is in a or the manufacturer
Chris,
I'm yourself.
Chris,
and
Chris,
all of a sudden
Chris,
it
stop,
doesn't work.
Chris, stop for a second, because we just had a blip and we didn't hear you. So what if the internet companies did what?
Oh, I'm saying, well, what if these internet companies had a conflicting business arrangement with your cell phone provider, and all of a sudden your cell phone didn't receive data anymore? Your apps and calendars wouldn't work. And you could take out large swaths of population's access to the mobile internet.
Chris, you seem to be making Michael Kopp's point in a lot of ways. Thanks very much for the call, and I hope you keep talking to your friends about this.
Thank you. A lot of these companies have cell business, too. They have the cell phones, too.
So the conflict of interest is built in.
So the conflict is built in. But I love the tomato example. Thank you. Thank you, Chris, for that.
We'll be Googling in just a minute. If you would like to get through to us, the phone lines are open. At least a couple of them are. 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, 941-3689. Or 877-941-3689 if you call us from the neighbor islands. And we have John on the line from Lihue. Aloha, John. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Well, one of the comments I had, it's just three now. I kind of agree with the last couple of callers, but I believe your guest, one of the primary jobs I believe he has is to repeat over and over what he's saying in a more boisterous or voiceful way and try to get others in the industry of journalism to say or repeat what he's saying. You have to let the general public know, number one, in a very forceful way, they are getting distortions and lies. You must use the word lie. It's okay to be political correct and be nice, and I know that, on the radio or in communication, you have to respect the opinions of others, but a lie is a lie, and you have to say it. As a journalist, you have to say, what you just heard is a lie, and then bring forth facts.
Well,
and I believe the general public can, as it grows, right now, so he's correct in all of his assumptions. But unless you become very blunt with what you're saying, and of course you can prove it because, you know, it's a lie when you hear it, but you have to let the general public know
okay.
that it
we,
is a lie.
Okay, we've heard you say we should be blunt and that maybe Mr. Kopp should be more forceful about that. He's been saying this for a very long time. You know, John is saying, you know, call it like it is. And
well,
just say that we're being lied to.
I'm trying to do that. Maybe I need to be a more boisterous fellow than I am, although there are people who accuse me of being a bomb thrower or too inflammatory in the rhetoric I use and all of that. But you're right. You have to bring these issues home to the people in terms that they understand. And when companies aren't telling the truth, you need to point out the fact that they're not telling the truth. And when they're not serving the public interest or living up to the obligations they have to the American people, you need to call them out, and you need to call them out in a direct way.
And that includes the SEC.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've tried to be as blunt as I can, and I haven't tried to blame everything on the FCC when it's under the control of one party at the expense of the other. They both have really failed the public interest in many, many ways. I'm hopeful now that the new FCC that we have under Chairman Tom Wheeler will do a better job. Some of the initial rhetoric is better. There's some good people working there. But in the final analysis, it's going to be performance that counts. And we've got this internet freedom issue that has to be decided very soon, like within the next month or two. I'm expecting that Mr. Wheeler will let us know where he sits on this topic. Comcast merger. That's going to have to be decided. This is the time for people to speak out. If you're interested in these issues, these are inflection points. The decisions have to be made. If you want to influence them, speak out at home. Speak up to your friends and neighbors. Speak up to your decision makers, your elected officials, and let the FCC know what you think.
That's the point that I think that you're really making, is that this is not something that's in the far-off future. This is not something that's next year. This is coming down the pike in the next 4 to 8 weeks.
It's the feature that's playing right now.
Absolutely.
Right.
941-3689 is our number, 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, 877-941-3689. If you call from the neighbor islands or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, or you can tweet me at BKOZHPR, at BKOZHPR. HPR. I want to hear from some of you students, because we've been talking to students at various other events and hearing them be just astounded that something like this could be happening in their country and that they just are totally unaware of all of this. If that was you and you've gotten yourself a little bit better informed and you're having conversations with friends, we want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 or tweet me at BKOZHPR. Going to Ray, calling us now from Kapolei. Aloha, Ray.
Aloha. I'd like to start off with what I heard when I first tuned in about 10 minutes ago, that I agree with the gentleman that, you know, government and businesses don't want consumer education or an informed electorate. And without net neutrality, I guess the main topic is you see on TV the ads for network speeds that say 7,500 megabits with a tiny, tiny disclaimer or words up to spoken so quickly it's often overlooked. It's ridiculous. I believe one gentleman earlier made a comment about the expense of Internet overseas and superior performance overseas. It's too bad we can't get something done that would give us broadband and net neutrality together.
Well, you're absolutely right. We need to have a mission to build broadband. Right now, what a lot of these companies are doing, and it fits their business plan pretty well, is rationing scarcity. Oh, we have to keep raising your prices, or we have to have data caps, or we have to slow this down because we only have so much bandwidth. But if we had a real national mission like they have in some of these other countries to build infrastructure, we could get on top of it. We could provide the kind of services you're talking about, faster speeds, faster downloads, and do it at lower prices. Now, to give President Obama some credit, you know, he's talking about the importance of infrastructure. We have collapsing infrastructure all around us, highways, bridges, airports, all the rest. But this is the infrastructure of the 21st century that we're talking about on this program here, this broadband technology. And we've, you know, you can't just mention it a few times and say, wouldn't it be nice if Congress would do this and send them a bill saying, please do this. You got to get out and lead. You have to tell the American people that this is important to your future, that I, the President of the United States, understand, you know, it's vital for jobs. It's vital we're going to get on top of any of these problems. Getting the story out is difficult. One or two of the callers previously mentioned journalism and the importance of having reporters and stories. And, you know, I am really on to that. That's a real cause of mine. I recently wrote a paper that was published
to
in the Columbia.
To all of us. You wrote a letter to all of us.
Yeah. Just trying. It's so difficult because journalism has been so decimated by the consolidation that we've been through, and there's fewer and fewer journalists out there. And the ones that are there often work for companies that say, you can't give voice to your private opinions. You can't even in your own time or on your own blog. And I'm not saying everybody does that, but a lot of them do. So whenever I go to a place like in Honolulu, we were out at the University of Hawaii just yesterday and saw more students today. I try to talk to the communication schools and the journalism schools and try to impress upon reporters the need to push from within to be able to write these stories. The need for them to band together if they're afraid for their jobs or whatever with other colleagues, so you can do it a little bit more anonymously perhaps. But journalists have always been part of change in this country. Go back to the Progressive Era at the beginning of the 20th century. There's a new book out now about Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft and the Muckrakers and how journalists were probably the most responsible for bringing to light the social problems that existed and the big trusts and the cartels and Standard Oil and the meatpacking industry and political graft in the cities. And you had publications that would run, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 word essays on this, and people would read them. Now, I don't know if the people would read them or not. because we're all used to, we got to have 200 words or less, but they're not being produced. And our journalism is not holding, it's not giving us facts, and it's not holding the powerful accountable, and those are the two things that should be. So it's not just that stories aren't getting reported. A lot of stories we don't even know about are out there. There's a lot of corruption and graft and all this going on right now. And the journalistic cadre is so much smarter than it used to be that they're not getting reported. It's hard to find the CEO of a media company who's going to tell his reporters, take a year off and get to the bottom of this story. You can go back as recently as the 50s and 60s. Bill Paley, who was a big media titan at CBS, but at least he understood the importance of the news, and he got all of his newsroom staff together one day and said, I want you folks to get the news. I don't want you to worry about the money. I've got Jack Benny, the entertainment shows. That'll get the money. You got the story. I'll take care of financing. Can you imagine the boss of CBS or NBC or ABC saying something like that now? No, because they're dancing to the tune of Wall Street and that quarterly report and the bottom line. That's what drives journalism right now.
And many of us can't even really remember when there were really true investigative pieces that were done long term like that. Most of it is in and out, get the story, put up the facts, keep people informed. That way they're going to have to make up their own minds. But it's not that deep dive. When Neil Milner was here on Wednesday, we were talking about Thomas Paterson's book, Informing the News, and the idea of having knowledge-based journalism, what that really means.
Right.
And yes, there may be a little bit of a fuzzy line when someone starts to insert some analysis, which means there's going to be perhaps some opinion in there, but based in a real look at what the facts are, what the context is, and the patterns that have emerged over time. That's
right.
Very different from what we're seeing now. So what kind of future do we have if we know this is where we are right now? We're not going to jump into some great Neverland tomorrow. But how do we get from where we are now?
Well, first of all, you're talking about opinion. In fact, what you got to go for is the truth. And the truth is not always this what they call objective journalism. He said, she said, and the reporter or the journalist makes no effort to say, that's ridiculous or this is right. But if the truth leads to that conclusion, I think it's the responsibility of journalists to say that. That was the second part of your question.
Just looking at where we are now and the context of what you say we need in terms of deep dives and the fact that the days of investigative journalism in the way that you're talking about them, take a year off, take 2 months off, take a week off, whatever it may be, to get to the bottom of a story, if that's possible, and then go forward. We've got some other callers on the line. Let me get to them first so that they can get in on this conversation. And if you would like to do that too, call us now, 941-3689. If you'd like to speak with former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps visiting Hawaii this week and in our studio tonight, 877-941-3689. If you call us from the neighbor islands or someplace else where you're listening to the live stream. And you can tweet me too, at BKOZHPR. Roger, calling us from Kaneohe. Aloha, welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I have a question for Mr. Cox. I've heard recently, been reminded about the English government filtering the Wi-Fi internet during the Olympics, try to make it more family-friendly. Is that really true, and how do you feel about that if you're trying to protect young children from wide-open access with so many Wi-Fi spots now?
Well, I don't know the details of the specific example, so I can't really comment on that. I know in the early days of the Internet, Congress passed legislation to try to protect kids on the Internet, which I don't think is necessarily a bad idea, but it was invalidated by the courts, so... this is a subject, I think, as we talk about the future of the Internet, that we really need to think about. Again, if we're transferring so much of our communication to that Internet, what serves the public interest? And it's hard just to engender that discussion right now. If you say we need to talk about public interest on the Internet, the talking heads of cable TV and the radio jocks are going to say, oh, you're trying to regulate the Internet. And that's not – if we can't get beyond that, then, all hope is lost, I think. what we're trying to do when we talk about internet freedom is to mean that consumers, to the maximum extent possible, are in charge of their online experience, that they can access the legal content of their choice. Maybe that goes to what you're talking about there, what's legal and what's illegal, that they can run the applications that they choose, attach to devices, and do all this in an environment where there's no business discrimination, that internet company or internet service provider isn't favoring its own businesses or its own deep-pocketed friends. So we have to get beyond that and have a discussion, and it's a legitimate question.
But what I hear you say is that, to Roger's point, it's the parents who should be the gatekeepers, not some company. And if you have Wi-Fi, then you're going to have to look at whatever
right.
you know your kid is looking at or accessing the Wi-Fi. I mean, accessing through Wi-Fi the internet,
right.
and you make those decisions, not have somebody else making decisions by virtue of what's coming through for good or for ill.
Well, times change, and you know we used to have indecency guidelines, and still do. It's part of the statute for broadcast television that when kids are likely to be watching, you can have excessively sexually oriented shows and all that. What bothers me even more than that is some of the gratuitous violence. But now times change. And I understand that, and you can't say what hour kids are watching or when they're on the internet.
There's no more family hour.
Not, and the family oversight, but that's got to be a large part of it, and that's a long-term proposition, and maybe that goes to that education we were talking about before and teaching kids who will be parents, vigilance is absolutely essential. There's a lot of stuff on the internet that I sure wouldn't want any of my grandkids seeing.
In not too long from now, we're going to be in the middle of an election. And between now and then, we're going to have lots and lots and lots of information coming at us, most of it in the form of ads.
Yes.
So at this point, aside from the fact that we talk about net neutrality, real information coming at us or being able to get to the bottom of it, if we don't have
right.
a lot of journalists out there doing that, and may be thwarted in trying to get information and not even know it, how do we set ourselves up for being able to make an informed decision?
Well, you do something about a little more diversity in ownership, a little more diversity of content. You talk about an election coming up, and I assume you're talking about here in Hawaii. There's a new report out today just to show you how bad the reporting is on elections done by the Media Council of Hawaii and Common Cause, and I'm affiliated now with Common Cause, that really looked at what's the ratio of political ads you see before an election to real political stories, news reports, and what that Common Cause and Media Council of Hawaii did pretty in-depth investigation, and they found in the average newscast there were like 7.2, I think, political commercials to 2.9 average political stories. And some newscasts had no stories of political news whatsoever, virtually no local TV coverage of state legislative races and things like that. So how do you make an informed decision when you have those gatekeepers in control and when they're dependent for a large part of their prosperity on these political ads? The campaign of 2012, the experts and authorities tell us now, probably cost this country $10 billion. A pretty good chunk of that went to buying time on media to run these political ads. And what I'm saying as a result of these studies is people are getting more information about political races or misinformation from these ads than they're getting from objective news stories.
And in some cases, those ads from third parties.
Yeah, and from third parties, from dark money, and totally undisclosed. Few people realize it, but the Federal Communications Commission, where I worked, actually has the authority to do something about that. And I've been pushing them to do something about that, and they've done nothing about that. But when you see those ads, you're home watching television and it says This ad brought to you by Citizens for Purple Mountain Majesties and Amber Ways of Grain, or Citizens for Motherhood and Apple Pie. And it's really some chemical company dumping sludge into the Pacific Ocean or something like that. I think it'd make a difference if people knew who was really sponsoring those ads. And the FCC has the authority, update rules currently on the books, to require that. And I think that would be very refreshing and very illuminating and help inform the American people about who's behind that ad that's trying to persuade you how to vote or who to vote for, and essentially to buy your vote.
But all that comes back to a point that you made earlier in the show where we were talking about the fact that these are public airwaves.
Exactly.
And that there's a stakeholdership and an ownership of those airwaves that we should be experiencing and feeling far more responsible for than we do.
We all have to. We need to take ownership. We are the owners, but you have to assert ownership. And otherwise, the big companies will run roughshod over you. And that's happened around the country, and it's happened here. You know, the media ownership rules are not as tight as they should be in the first place. But now the companies have found ways to bypass that, and it's happened right here with shared services agreements and things like that, where one station controls another, doesn't maybe technically own it, but that's a clever way around media ownership caps, and those kind of strategies have to be, eliminated.
I mean, all of this is sounding very good in terms of an abstract argument, but for a lot of people, they don't see this as being the reality of their lives. I mean, this is pretty heady stuff. And for most people who are, in many cases, fairly ignorant about how their government really works, how do you start a conversation with someone who doesn't feel threatened by all of this or feel that he or she should exert any ownership over any of this?
By saying this affects you. This is the way we're going to communicate outside of our personal communications and talking to one another, increasingly on the internet. This affects your ability to get a job. If you're a student and you don't have access to high-speed fiber broadband and you're competing against somebody, some kid or student elsewhere who does, or some student in another country who does, you are handicapped. You have one hand tied behind your back, looking for a job, educating yourself, caring for your health. That's all pretty personal. That affects a major part of your life. Or the news and information that you get that you're going to make your decisions on how you're going to conduct your how you're going to cast your vote and all of that. So people need to begin to realize this is not the theory. This is the practice. This is the reality. This impacts your life. So you can either be a part of the discussion and try to influence that the way that's going, or you can say this doesn't affect me and hold back. And there's an old axiom that says decisions without you are usually decisions against you. And that applies oh so true to the future of the internet. So what we need is those folks at the FCC not just hearing from Comcast and AT&T and Verizon and Google and all the big guys. I'm not saying they shouldn't hear from them. They should. And when I was a commissioner, I always welcomed all these people in the office. Let me hear what you're up to. Tell me how it's going to serve the public interest. That's fine. But those aren't the only constituents or the only people we ought to be looking at. That's why I was big on let's get the FCC out of Washington. When we had the ownership fights with Michael Powell in 2003 and Chairman Kevin Martin in 2007, I went on the road. One of my colleagues went with me on the road. We went to town meetings around the country. And before we conclude that people aren't interested in this, I think it's instructive to note that when you go to a meeting like that, and we went all around the country and we held town hall meetings, we held them in the evening when working people could come out. Some of these meetings would attract 400, 500, 600 people. Some of them, we had an open mic, and I never left, and my friend never left until the last person had spoken. Some of these meetings went on for 8 to 9 hours. There's a lot of people in this country who do know something is wrong. And I don't think that applies just to this important issue of media and the telecommunications. I think the American people know something is sadly out of whack, but they're so skeptical or so doubtful that action can be taken because they know the special interests are in the saddle. They know that big money is in the saddle. And what I'm trying to say is Yes, that's reality. Big money is in the saddle, but citizen action can still work. Personalize it can still work. When you talk to somebody and try to convince them, bring it home to their lives. That's what's essential. And isn't that really how reform has, real systemic reform has always happened in this country? It's not waiting for somebody to come along from on high and rescue us and do all these good things. That happens once in a while, but that's not the story of democracy. The story of democracy is working in the hinterlands and every nook and cranny of this country to build reform movements. That's what happened with abolitionism. That's what happened with women's rights. That's what happened with worker rights. That's what's happening with LGBT rights. That's what's happening with disability rights. And in the final analysis, some of these problems can be solved by good decisions by the FCC. There's no question about that. But this future of our communications ecosystem is going to be determined finally by what the American people want and if they really want reform, to work for that reform.
We're coming to the end of the hour, and I just wanted to ask you, to having just said everything you've just said about the American people, there are still young writers coming up, young publications who are coming up, who are in some ways trying to pull away from whatever they view as being the establishment. And do you have any concern that they're, in fact, going to go off and sort of emulate the establishment a little later on and that they need to be a little bit more forewarned?
Well, I hope not. But, you know, the thing on the Internet is we see so much creativity and entrepreneurship and innovation. But with the business plans we've got, the successful ones, what happens? They get bought out. They become instant millionaires or billionaires, and that's fine. But a lot of them just fail. But I think it's always a danger that those who may be vigilant right now maybe lose some of that vigilance as time goes by. But if we can engender the kind of dialogue that I'm talking about here, I think a lot of people are going to participate in it. And I don't think they're going to get tired of that dialogue until they achieve some real honest-to-goodness reforms. And if there's one takeaway I would like people listening to this show to have from this, we have a lot of issues in this country right now. None of them are going to be solved until we get our media right, until we get it correct. If we're going to have democracy, you're going to have as a predicate media democracy, because without it, none of the other obstacles that we confront is going to be overcome.
So it doesn't matter what your issue is, whether you're talking about the state of the economy, what's happening overseas, anything right. That you want to pick, just whatever it is that means something to you, unless you have this kind of dialogue and protecting media protecting democracy with a small d, none of the rest matters.
Forget about resolving it unless you get media right.
I really have enjoyed the time that
Me
we've
too,
been able
to
spend
Me too, and thanks to your
together.
Callers.
Thanks so much. Wish we'd have heard from more of you, especially some of those students that we were talking to who said, I had no idea. Well, maybe perhaps now you do. Michael Copps, enjoy the rest of your time here in Hawaii. Thanks very much for the hour you spent with us and for coming to Hawaii in the first place. We hope we see more of you.
Thank you for the public service you do in talking about these issues.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Thanks very much for joining us tonight for Town Square. I will see you tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock for the conversation. We hope you'll plan to get your favorite morning brew and join us then. Meanwhile, have yourselves a good evening and take good care. Aloha.